This is Rita Forster, and I'm going to read chapter 29 to 31. When Stephen eased out the front door, he was wearing red pajamas and a gray sweatshirt. His light brown hair was mussed, his eyes bleary. The flashlight he was carrying sliced through the darkness. The babies turned towards him and froze. Their eyes glowed like little moons. Flash squealed in fear. Stephen clicked off his light, and Flash seemed to calm a bit, although he was definitely hiccuping. "Hey," Stephen whispered. "Hi," Samar whispered back. Stephen sat down next to Samar. The babies watched with interest. "Why do they come to you?" Stephen asked. "I don't know. It's like magic." "No." Samar shook her head. "I'm just quiet. They like that." Bongo flew down to Samar's shoulder. "Hello," she said to Stephen, mimicking Samar's voice. "Wow," he said. "That's amazing. Yesterday, I heard her imitate a doorbell." Stephen grinned. "She gave me this key," Samar said, holding it up. "I don't know what it's for. A diary or a jewelry box? Maybe." "Or the world's smallest door," Stephen joked. For a while, everyone fell silent. Even the baby raccoons were still. At last, Stephen held out his hand, revealing Samar's wish. "I found this," he said. Even in the moonlight, Samar's blush was visible. She looked away. "I'm sorry about that word," Stephen said softly. "The word on the tree. We didn't. It wasn't us." Samar nodded. "My parents aren't bad people. They're just afraid of things." Stephen shrugged. "So are mine," said Samar. "I heard my father talking about moving. If we can find a safe place to go." She gave a sad smile. "If there even is such a place." "I'm sorry," Stephen said again. The babies, sensing Stephen could be trusted, began to tussle and romp. Harold and the smallest ewe searched for bugs. Rose Petal and her brother, Hot Buttered Popcorn, played tug of war with a long piece of grass. "I'll miss them," Samar said. "I hope you don't move," Stephen said. A light blinked on in Stephen's house. "I should go," he said. "If my parents see me, I should go." "Night," Samar said in a whisper. "Oh, the things I wanted to say to those two. I wanted to tell them that friendship doesn't have to be hard. That sometimes we let the world make it hard. I wanted to tell them to keep talking. I wanted to make a difference, just a little difference, before I left this lovely world. And so I did it. I broke the rule. Stay," I said. Chapter 30. The animals gaped at me in astonishment. Even the youngest babies knew about the "don't talk to people" rule. Bongo darted to my top branch. "Red," she cried in a strangled whisper. "You can't." "Oh, but I can," I said. "What have I got to lose?" But, as I was saying, I returned my attention to Stephen and Samar. They were staring at me, jaws dropped, eyes wide, as frozen as Flash had been not long ago. "We're dreaming," Stephen murmured, "right?" "At the same time?" Samar asked. "Is that possible?" "Pinch me," Stephen said. Samar complied. "Definitely felt that," Stephen reported. "Maybe it was a dream pinch," Samar suggested. "Excuse me," I interrupted. "I have 216 rings worth of wisdom to convey, and not much time." Stephen reached for Samar's hand. "If it's a dream, at least it's a cool one." And so I began. Chapter 31. I haven't always been a wish tree. It happened in 1848, long before I was surrounded by concrete and cars, when I was just a few decades old. Still a youngster by Red Oak standards. No longer a lanky sapling. I was solid and strong, but not anchored to the earth the way I am now. This was a time, like many other times, when hungry, desperate people sailed on crowded boats to settle here. Many of them ended up, as they always seemed to, in my neighborhood. The blue-green houses were brown then and filled to overflowing with new arrivals. Sometimes the newcomers were welcomed. Sometimes they were not. But still they came, hoping and wishing, as people always do. One of our newest residents was a young Irish girl named Maeve. She voyaged across the Atlantic with her 19-year-old brother, who died of dysentery during the trip. Their mother had passed away shortly after Maeve was born, their father when the children were 9 and 12. Maeve was solid and plain, but when she smiled, it was like a sunshine peeking through clouds. She had a deep laugh, and her hair was as brilliantly red as my finest autumn attire. 16, alone and penniless, Maeve shared a tiny room with 5 other immigrants. She worked night and day, cleaning and cooking and doing all she could do to stay alive. Maeve soon discovered she was gifted at caring for the sick. She had no special knowledge, no secret remedies, but she was kind and patient, and she knew how to soothe a fevered brow with a cool cloth, as well as anyone. What she didn't know, she was willing to learn. As time passed, word grew of Maeve's abilities. People brought her their sick piglets and their lame horses, their coughing children, and fretful babies. Always she explained that she wasn't sure she could help. But since people in the neighborhood were too poor to go to a doctor, they turned to Maeve. And since people believed she could help them get better, Maeve tried to live up to their hopes. When she succeeded, and even when she didn't, patients and their families would leave small tokens for her. A whittled figurine of a bird, a hairpin, a half loaf of bread. Once, someone even left a leather-covered journal with a tiny silver key that opened its lock. When Maeve was out tending to someone who was sick, people took to leaving their thank yous in my lowest hollow. It was still a fresh wound, just a couple of seasons mended. But because it faced the house where Maeve roomed and not the street, It was a safe place to leave a token of gratitude. That's when I realized that hollows can be a good thing for people, not just birds and animals. Little did I know just how good.